And a good evening to you and welcome to another program in our series, A Living Bill of Rights. Each month we have a 90-minute call-in dealing with various aspects of the U.S. Constitution Bill of Rights. And tonight, for the second time in this series, for some of our listeners, we will be visiting the church and state question. As it is stated in the First Amendment to the Constitution, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And much of our discussion this evening will relate, I assume, to what establishment means and what prohibition means in terms of the Bill of Rights. We have State Senator Al Bishop of Billings in our studio with us tonight to talk with you. And along with Senator Bishop, we have Kyle Ann Gray, a Billings attorney in private practice, and Scott Crichton, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana, my usual partner in these broadcasts. And we're going to give each of our guests tonight a chance to make some opening comments about our subject, which is officially Church and State, sectarian civics. And I'm going to ask Senator Bishop to open things up with a brief statement about his concept of what the First Amendment means with respect to the relationship between religion, organized religion, the state, and the Constitution. And then we'll give Kyle Gray a chance to do the same thing. Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Marvin. Until I read that article in the Billings Gazette in connection with the removal of the monument from the courthouse lawn in Miles City, the one that had the Ten Commandments carved into it, I really had not ever done anything proactive in connection with that the First Amendment and that particular part of it. But that was so close to home, Miles City, not very far from where we are now, that I did. I wrote a letter to the ACLU, probably big mistake maybe, but Scott remembered the letter at least and called me a week or so ago. But anyway, after I read the letter, the article, I thought, gee, I've got a really original idea. That, no, the framers, the crafters of the Constitution and the First Amendment never intended that to keep religion out of government. They intended to keep, their intention was to keep government out of religion. Big mistake on my part, because thinking that it was an original idea, that is. It isn't, of course, and that's been bandied about and kicked around for a long time, that very thing. But I think and Marvin asked me to keep this brief, and I will. I had a longer opening statement, but I'm going to try to break it down if I can. When the First Amendment was passed, it had only two purposes. The first one, that there would be established no national church for the 13 states. That was the intent. You got to remember, these folks came from a lot of their forebears, and they weren't very far back, less than 150 years or so. These folks' ancestors settled this country, and they came from Europe principally, and to avoid persecution because of religion for the most part. And for instance, England, France, Spain, and all those, they had a state religion. And those folks did not like that, so they came to America and settled here. So that had to be one of the big reasons for that provision in the Constitution. They never intended to keep religion out of government. They were very devout people. The ones that drafted the Constitution that were also devout Christians at that time. But they were very concerned. From what I've read in the letters and things, there's very little recorded data or recordings about the Constitutional Convention and the First Amendment drafting of that. But from the letters in that, they were more concerned with, they didn't want to have religion, you didn't have to profess a faith in a particular religion or religion at all to hold an office. But you did, they did want you to have faith. They figured that people that had some religious faith or upbringing or feelings would be better governed, better governors than someone that had absolutely no faith at all. They'd be, those people would be tyrannical, cruel, brutal, harsh, whereas the people that had the faith would be more kind, benevolent, and so forth. So with that, I'll throw it open to the rest of them. That's, I tried to cut it as short as I could.
Well, that's a good opening. And Kyle, I'll give you an opening of about the same length, and then we'll get in. I'll give our listeners a warning that you are going to be able to participate in this discussion with your questions or your comments after Kyle Gray and Scott Crichton have their opening comments. And the number across the state of Montana and in northern Wyoming, the toll-free number is 1-800-441-2941 if you would like to participate in this discussion. If you are in the Billings calling area, call us at 657-2941. But the number for the larger region around Montana and northern Wyoming is 1-800-441-2941, and we'll give you a chance to make a comment or ask a question in this discussion. I think in the last one of these programs we had 24 listeners on the air, so you're welcome to make your comments. Kyle?
Well, with all due respect to Senator Bishop, what he's just given us is what is sort of a canned history that the religious right has been pushing, oh, for the last 20 or 30 years or so, and particularly in the last 10 years or so, a fellow named David Barton has written this so-called history of the Establishment Clause, which is, once you go back and look at the documents of the framers, is just wrong. In fact, as you can see from the works of Madison and Jefferson, who were two of the most important drafters of what became the First Amendment, Madison actually drafting it and Jefferson being his mentor and from France keeping in contact with them, that it was meant to be two things. Yes, to keep government out of religion. That's the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. But the establishment, the clause of the First Amendment, in fact, was meant to be what has come to be called the wall between church and state. And it's not the one-way wall that the senator talked about here, but clearly was meant to be a two-way wall, both to keep government out of religion and religion out of government. And in fact, at the time, it didn't have anything to do with the national churches in the 13 states. At the time it was written, the First Amendment only applied to the federal government. And it wasn't until after the Civil War in the 14th Amendment, and then much later, the Supreme Court reading into the history of the 14th Amendment, that the First Amendment began to be applied to the states. It's also a myth that the framers of the Constitution were very devout Christians. Many of them were not. Many of them were deists. Some of them were devout Christians, but they were Christians of various sects. Not sexes, sex, S-E-C-T-S. I hope that came across correctly. Unfortunately, Christians of, or non-Christians of various sexes at that time were the women were not allowed to speak out on these issues. But the men who were the framers of our Constitution came from various backgrounds. They knew from the history where they came from, and many of them, in fact, were from England, the horrible wars that went on between Christians, between Protestants and Catholics, or between Protestants and Protestants. For example, the English Civil War was precisely that, a war between Anglicans and Puritans. And they knew that allowing government to have a say in religion, or to have religion to have a say in government, was a very bad idea. And their brilliance has played out through the centuries of our country. I mean, we see today, for example, that here in the United States, where we have many, many faiths who celebrate a winter holiday, whether it be Christmas or Yule or Hanukkah or just a secular winter holiday, we manage to celebrate it in a feeling of peace and goodwill. And, for example, in Indonesia, we have Muslims bombing Christian churches. And in Israel, we have Jews fighting Muslims. And all over the world, we have had and continue to have religious strife. And we have not, for the most part, had that here in the United States. And that is due to the brilliance of the framers in giving us a two-way wall that separates church from state.
Thank you for your opening comments, both of you, and we'll get to our calls here in just a moment. Scott Crichton crafted the title of tonight's program, Church and State Sectarian Civics. What did you have? That's a pretty good title, Scott, but what did you mean by sectarian civics?
Surprised, are you, Marvin? Well, it just seems in the years that I've worked for the Civil Liberties Union that it's a recurring theme where there are people who are in government who have an interest in advancing religion through government. And it seems to me, you would expect this working for the Civil Liberties Union, that wall of separation is something that needs to be acknowledged and fortified and not skirted. Yet it seems also that session after session, year after year, when there's a convening of the legislature in Montana or the U.S. Congress, that there are what I think are insidious attempts to undermine that, whether it's through vouchers for parochial education or laws that are trying to say, you know, it is just fine to be putting the Ten Commandments up in our public buildings and to expect everybody to respect that as not just a Christian message, but as a message that all of us understand and embrace. And I guess for me, what comes through working for an organization that respects minority rights is that we really need to remember that our Constitution not only protects you from to be able to believe anything you want, but it also gives you the right to not believe in any supernatural or spiritual being or creation. And it's not to say that anybody's right and anybody's wrong. It's just to say everybody's right, that what is so dear in your own conception of how cosmology works, or how the cosmos fits with us, is it's up to everybody's interpretation. So my point in trying to advance this discussion tonight about the separation of church and state is to put it in the new context of the new millennium that's dawning, and what we can expect to see from both this upcoming legislature in Montana and from the new Congress and the Bush administration.
Where did the term wall of separation come from? Who devised that term, do you know?
Yeah, it's a term from Thomas Jefferson, and it's in a famous letter that he wrote to the Danbury Baptists. And at that time, in 1807, I believe it was, the Baptists were a minority religion. Baptists had actually, since the time of Henry VIII, when he was burning them at the stake, they were sort of the favorite heretics. It's ironic that they've become, in many ways, especially in the South, a group that now wants to do away with separation of church and state, because in America, at least, they were protected by it for so long, because the idea of the Baptist, that you would have adult baptism and not infant baptism, was seen as blasphemy, as a heresy, and they were very discriminated against. And the Baptists in Danbury, Connecticut, wrote to Thomas Jefferson and asked him to please explain what his concept was of the First Amendment. And that's where, in that letter, the phrase separation of church, the wall between church and state was first used.
Jefferson acknowledged in his writings or along the way that he could very well have been a hypocrite and possibly inconsistent, because he does say in the Declaration of Independence, he refers to the laws of nature and of nature's God. He invokes that in justifying the rights that people have to separate the American people from the British people and so forth. And then later on in his life, in an exchange of letters with John Adams, in which they are differing about the role of the deity in society, Jefferson writes to Adams at one point, "Whether you have a religion or no religion, neither picks my pocket nor breaks my bones."
And that was the real Jefferson.
That's the real Jefferson, according to a lot of people.
Yes.
Then you have John Adams, who was a Unitarian. I notice here in my copy of the Constitution that the Speaker of the House of Representatives at the time was Frederick Muhlenberg, who was a Lutheran. So we had a lot of variety there.
We did indeed.
We have our phone number once again, if you'd like to participate in this discussion with your comments or your questions, 1-800-441-2941. Whether you are in Montana or Wyoming, that number will be toll-free for you, 1-800-441-2941. If you would like to talk about issues relating to church and state, in the Billings area, that's a local call, you can call 657-2941. I want to pass on for our discussion here in the immediate future some comments that we put on our website in introducing this program to listeners. We said President-elect Bush has announced an Office of Faith-Based Action to be located in the White House. The new president will build on his Texas policy of having religious organizations carry out certain social services in partnership with state and local government. Should religious groups, we ask, be subsidized by government or have official duties assigned to them by government? Many Americans say that it's about time that we ask compassionate religious institutions to play a greater role, especially in providing social services in our society. Many others see a slippery slope from feeding, housing, and clothing the poor to saving their souls, clearly a violation of the Constitution, separation of church and state. We have a caller on a cell phone. Good evening.
Good evening.
Go ahead.
If we were to give an arbitrary, if we were just to give a number to each religious sect, from Hindus to Muslims to all the different Christian faiths, including not believing in a deity at all and giving that the number zero, mathematically, zero is a number. So by not allowing any faith into any public systems whatsoever, isn't that in fact forcing a sect or faith or lack of faith on everyone?
Okay, so you're saying that by keeping all of them out, you're in effect imposing a policy of non-religion on everybody? Okay, your radio is providing some feedback. If you want to stay on the line, you'll have to turn your radio down just a bit.
Okay.
And we'll give our people in the studio here a chance to respond to your comment. Senator Bishop?
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. Never given it a bit of thought up right till now. But I would like to make a couple of comments responding to Kyle and Scott, that it's really comical for me to be called part of the religious right. I think all my friends who know me would really find that rather humorous. And also, Scott, I don't know that you were pointing a finger at me or anything, but I've never sponsored, to my knowledge, any legislation at all that would be considered an attack upon the First Amendment, and I have no intention of doing so. But anyway, your concept,
that wasn't directed to you.
Yeah, it's kind personally. Of a backward. It is a. Well, I'm going to let the others respond to that. I want to think about it for a minute.
Oh, I have thought about it a lot. And, in fact, what the caller has said is demonstrably untrue. If you look at the places around the world, especially the Western Europe, which, of course, is where the majority of our traditions come from, although that's, we have more and more diversity in our population, not as true. But if you look around at the Western European countries, the countries that have established churches have very, very, very low numbers of believers and churchgoers. In England, for example, the Anglican Church is basically dying, and the two religions there that are actually growing are the Mormon Church and pagan spirituality. And in the United States, to the contrary, the one place where from the beginning we have not had an established national church, the numbers are incredibly high. We have an incredible diversity of religious beliefs in this country, and we have, I think the last numbers I read were like 95% of the population believes in some form of the deity. And so to say that keeping government or keeping religion out of government somehow establishes atheism or something of that nature is just, as I said, demonstrably wrong.
Did you have another comment, listener? Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have another comment?
No. I guess I can't really. I guess I don't make the correlation to where just because 95% of everybody believes in something, that then. I guess I wasn't referring to this as having a negative impact on the numbers of believers. I guess I was just wondering why, if 95% of the population believes in something, why are we adhering to the 5% of the people that believe in nothing and just kind of sitting on, just keeping our mouths shut and not letting, Johnny say his prayers at lunch and Billy getting his mat out and praying to the east and allowing each and every person to demonstrate what they want to wherever they want.
I don't think there's any prohibition against those individuals doing those things themselves. I think there's a prohibition from the court in having them, in effect, require everyone around them to engage in the same activity. In other words, if you do it in public, then you are sort of forcing it on other people. If you do it privately, then that's your business, you know.
They're doing that in Texas right now at the football games, and that they had a court decision. I believe Kyle can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but they prohibited prayers before in the stadium before the football game. But the fans are doing
high
it.
High school football.
Yeah, high school football.
Right. But they're still forcing it on everybody, whether they want to do it or not.
But they're doing it. The fans are still doing that in violation or whatever the court orders. So there's no way in the world you're going to stop people who are dead set on doing something like that. Civil disobedience is what this country was built on.
It may not
well,
be.
Well, of course, that's what George Wallace said when he wanted to keep the United States and certainly Alabama segregated, and the people of Alabama disagreed with Brown versus Board of Education.
Those football prayers may not be strictly illegal if they're not prescribed, but they certainly are discourteous to the people who are not involved in them in a public place. Billings on the phone. Go ahead.
It's certainly an interesting situation we've gotten ourselves into here with a court-appointed president and the millennium looming ahead of us. I only wanted to observe that a good deal of what I hear being promoted these days in the name of religion, the public ought to remember, is in fact neither old line nor is it something that comes from even some of the 19th century sects. What you have promoted today as American Christianity, and Pat Robertson, Gary Bauer, and that crowd are part of it, is a millennialist viewpoint that is extremely debatable amongst Orthodox theologians. And it is, in fact, an attempt to create a secularly supported church-state religion. And it is a religion condemned even by Baptists at one time, who, in fact, under John Leland, were instrumental in getting Madison into the original Constitutional Congress. The other observation I have to make, and I'll hang up, it seems to be forgotten that the Constitution was formed because we had failed under the Articles of Confederation, not because these were people hot off the boat out at Plymouth who were trying to make sure they kept the rock clean. This was a matter of trying to establish a neutral situation where no one would feel that they were being denied housing or a job or being taxed or put in jail because they didn't bow to the proper place. And if, in fact, some of what I hear Mr. Bishop promoting, and I think he means well by it, were to be put in place, we are laying the groundwork or the kind of sectarian warfare that, to disagree with Ms. Gray somewhat, is going on in the Far East, where not all Muslims, but terrorist sects, splinter groups out of those crowds are doing the bombing.
No, I agree.
That's
with
the
that,
danger
yes.
of these things.
Yeah.
And I want to give Senator Bishop a chance to respond.
The big thing, the two things are causing a problem out there with this thing. And I, as I say, it's really ironic for me to be called part of the religious right. This is my first time ever, so I don't know what to make of that. But anyway, there's a lot of paranoia in the country regarding religion. I'm only lately come to religion. 8 years ago, I was baptized. Never had any religious bent up until that time. I attend church fairly regularly now, and I have a belief. I have a faith. But we also have in the country, I'm a lawyer, have been a lawyer for 48 years, and I have people that I went to law school with who went on to become judges. And I know there's the one judge in Kentucky, and I can't believe the decision. I mean, as an attorney who's been around that long, and I was not the brightest in my class, maybe, but I was up there and had good grades. And so my opinion is every bit as valid as any judge's opinion that I can see. I'm a lawyer. That's all they are. There are lawyers who were elected to the bench. They have no special skills any more than I do. And in my opinion, to hold as this one judge did in Kentucky is just plumb ridiculous.
Let me ask one question, both of you and Mr. Crichton, Ms. Gray, and I'll hang up and listen to your response. First of all, is it not possible that a great many of these people, well-meaning and otherwise good neighbors, often confuse religion with the culture of their area? And secondly, can you demonstrate to me by argument, since you've had legal training and I'm just a curbstone cowboy, can you demonstrate to me how people's religion and the moral fabric of the country is threatened if we remove what is, in fact, an imposed religious construct from a public tax-based supported place? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, we do have a caller from Miles City. I'm going to let the senator finish his reference to the Kentucky judge there, and then we'll get on to our next call.
Well, as I say, this Kentucky judge held that in Eastern schools and courthouses in Eastern Kentucky are removing their displays of historical documents, including the Mayflower Compact, an excerpt from the Declaration of Independence, the national motto, In God We Trust, and the preamble to the state's constitution, to comply with an order from federal judge Jennifer Kaufman, who said the displays are a violation of the First Amendment. Judge Jennifer Kaufman has no more standing, I submit, than I do to render an opinion on something like that. I probably have more experience than she has, for one thing. I've probably been around longer. But I think these judges constitute a tiny, so minuscule part of a minority, and I don't know what possesses them once they get on the bench to they lose contact with people. And that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with American people, 200 and some million Americans out there who have an interest in something like this, and who aren't, most of them aren't paranoid, and they don't see that the government is trying to establish a religion. I see that absolutely nowhere, that government is trying to establish a national religion. If it's there, it's well hidden. I've never seen it, and I would fight it just as much as anyone else would.
Can we move on to a caller from Miles City? Are you there?
I am.
Go ahead.
I'd like to ask the panel to apply the theory of the statute of limitations in regards to some of the offenses. For instance...
Can you speak up for us?
Yes. If a religious motto, the Ten Commandments, has been on a public building for 60 years, does the statute of limitations come into effect, or even the philosophy of a statute of limitations? In other words, if there was a violation. No one complained or filed suit at the time or within a specific amount of time. Is there a statute of limitations effect?
The short answer to that is no, that there's no statute of limitations on invoking your constitutional rights. And a good example of that is the law was in this country for decades of Plessy versus Ferguson, which was separate but equal. And, of course, in Brown versus Board of Education, that was overturned by the Supreme Court, saying that was a wrong reading of the 14th Amendment. But a more involved answer is sometimes. That is what the Supreme Court said in the Marsh case when they were faced with the question of state chaplains in the legislature. And they relied in part in upholding that practice on the fact that this was a tradition that had been ongoing for many, many years. But they didn't say you couldn't challenge because a period of years had followed. They simply used that as one of their rationale for upholding it.
Well, if you've got an old federal building that says, "In God We Trust" on it, I mean, there's not much you can do about that. I mean, if you're an atheist or somebody who's offended by that, I mean, they're not going to tear the building down to satisfy your complaint. And in that sense, a statute of limitations is grandfathered. The "In God We Trust" is sort of grandfathered in, or grandmothered in, or whatever we call it, you know, these days. I would like to move on to a cell phone call from Helena. Go ahead.
Hello?
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of getting off the track here a little bit, but I did want to say, and I mentioned it to Scott Crichton the other day on a ski trail, that one of my little beefs, I don't have any problem with, separation of church and state. I think it's necessary. But when they start pulling all these Christmas tunes out of these little kids' Christmas programs, I really hate to. Those are great melodies and they're great musical pieces, and I like to hear all that stuff. And I'm also kind of curious, if they're not going to acknowledge Christmas and sing about it, which is, I figure that's what it's sort of about, why do they even let the kids out of school for Christmas?
Now, at the elementary school where my 9-year-old goes, they had traditional Christmas tunes, they had a Hanukkah or tune or two, and they had a little demonstration of what Kwanzaa is.
Excellent.
And that's a multicultural program that respects several traditions, but in each one of them there was some acknowledgement of God.
That's excellent, Marvin. I just don't want them to sweep that all under the carpet and sing about nothing but Rudolph.
Well, artistically, I would agree with you.
As far as I'm aware, there's actually only one case on that, at least a circuit court authority, and it's out of the Seventh Circuit. And the court said that Christmas carols of a traditional nature are fine as long as they're in a program that recognizes diverse traditions. And I am not aware of a situation where a court has ordered a school program to stop singing Silent Night.
Well, it may be easier in a small school system to just sweep them under the carpet and not do them at all than trying to find some other religious things that maybe there aren't any, there's nobody there that knows anything about them, other mm-hmm. tunes or whatever.
Yeah.
I just really like to hear them songs, and I miss Christmas when the whole Christmas goes by and I don't hear some of them. They're great songs, and I think people should sing them louder, and they always forget the second verses. You know what I mean?
That's right. That's right. But they do that with America the Beautiful, too.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the point the caller's making, and I've thought about this a lot since we talked about it on the trail, is that it's sometimes easier for people in schools to decide that the path of least resistance is the best path to follow. And, you know, I don't think that's true. I think that teachers should be challenged if they're going to address the celebrations of the season to see that that's balanced and that the diversity of religion is reflected in it. I do think it's unfortunate. Occasionally we get calls from people who are not Christians, who feel that their kids are being evaluated in their music programs about how well they participate in the Christian anthems. And I do see a problem with that. I mean, I do think it's unfair for a kid who doesn't believe in our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, which everybody else is singing about, to be graded or expected to just stay silent and be acknowledged as the odd person out. So I think there's a delicate balance that's got to be found through creative curriculum and through people that are really paying attention. And if it is balanced, I don't think anybody's going to find a problem about it. The bigger problem is what happens when you've got a band teacher or a choral teacher who is an evangelical who really not only likes the spirit of the song, but is intent on saving souls through it. And, those things happen.
Go ahead.
I just think that music's something to rejoice and sing about, and the season's something to rejoice and sing about. Celebrate, that's the key word, I think. And at least they get a little bit of why this is going on besides just an excuse to go to the shopping mall. I don't see why there's white people singing the blues and there's no reason why a Muslim couldn't sing some of these songs. It doesn't mean you have to have lived that or anything. It's just music. Just have a good time with it.
I think it's true what you're saying, if the community can go both ways. I mean, I learned something about Kwanzaa that I didn't know, who invented it, where it came from, and why they invented it in this elementary school program. And I told the music teacher that I appreciated that.
Yeah.
I was not being led to believe in it religiously. I was being educated about it, and I thought that was a creative thing for the teacher to do. When they say put Christ back into Christmas, that's something specifically for Christians. People who are not Christians should not be expected to participate in that. To them, it's a cultural holiday. Don't you think?
Well, you think it's cultural? I guess it's traditional. It's definitely sort of traditional in this country and a lot of countries.
Yeah.
But, Marvin, I'm not so up on that old history to know. I imagine that Christmas was started out just being religious, and somewhere they came along with Santa Claus and all that. But
the church took over the winter solstice, which was a pagan holiday.
There you
originally.
Go. Yep, yeah. That's what I heard the other day. Maybe it was on NPR.
Christianity's quite a late comer to the solstice.
And it was a creative thing to do. The church, in fact, still does it at various places in the world where it is competing with local, tribal and other kinds of religions, and it adopts many of the practices of those religions and sort of puts a Christian, that's why many people in the world nearly worship the Virgin Mary as a goddess, because those people had a religious background that did involve worshiping goddesses, and she's a Christian goddess to them, you know.
Uh-huh.
So it all sort of fits together, but it's a clever way to accommodate, I think.
Why Christianity was so successful.
Yeah. Marvin, I'd like to respond just maybe facetiously to something you said. You said just a bit ago the school teacher was saving souls.
No, I didn't say that.
You see, you said she was, but that's what she was trying to say, she was saving souls.
No,
if she was trying.
To save souls then. But anyway, is saving souls a bad thing? I mean, that's a question.
The government, yes.
Yeah,
it's a very bad thing.
Yeah, in school, I don't want my kids' souls saved in school.
What if you're a Protestant and the person who's trying to save your child's soul is a Catholic who's trying to save this person's soul through a Hail Mary prayer?
You know, the two fastest growing religions in America are the Mormon Church and the Muslim religion. Neither of those are totally compatible with some of the practices of traditional Christianity. I mean, they have their own way of doing things. And they also happen to be the subject of a great deal of prejudice. I mean, I came from the eastern part of the United States out here about 17 years ago and was amazed at how much discrimination I found against Mormons out here. And it surprised me because I didn't know why. It was some of the same sort of criticisms that I heard in forms of discrimination against Jews in the East, which was an interesting
thing. Well, we saw it in the uproar over the building of the temple here in Billings.
So there's a lot of room for prejudice all over the place, and tolerance, if we can use that term, although that's not a term I especially like, because it suggests putting up with something you don't like. Acceptance, maybe, of different traditions is valuable, and people benefit from it. And I would be critical if anyone attempted to save my
child's soul in public school, because I think that's a matter of family and church and home.
But where are you going with that, Al? Do you think that's a good
families,
idea?
Families, I would like that akin to sex education. Well, it used to be the families also taught sex education at home. They don't do that anymore. They're doing it in schools by handing out condoms for the most part. But maybe the same thing should the parents are not maybe doing their job at home with regard to religion. Maybe something has to be done along those lines. I mean, is sex education more important than saving souls, as Marvin put it here a while ago?
Well, I referred here in a thing that I read from our website that said, others see a slippery slope from feeding and housing and clothing the poor to saving their souls. That's a criticism that some people have of President-elect Bush's proposal to have religious organizations work with the government in carrying out certain social services, as he has done in Texas. I did not say anything about saving souls beyond that, and I think Scott made a reference to people going from offering a music program at school to actually saving souls if one is of a evangelical tradition, maybe.
That rationale was why we in history had the Crusades, when Christians decided to impose themselves upon Jews and Muslims and basically say, convert or die. That's one of the horrors that the framers were trying to prevent.
Do you see anything of like that even remotely or happening in this country?
It did happen early on in the history of this country.
I'm talking, let's talk current.
Well, you can't
be a contemporary here.
Contemporary is not the point.
I'm not responsible, nor are you, for things that happened 100, 200 years
but
ago.
We are
responsible for what happens today and tomorrow and the next day.
Those who ignore the rules of history are doomed.
But governments also create climates. I mean, they just do. And we have a climate in our... I want to get to President-elect Bush's proposed Office of Faith-Based Action, because I think many people believe that that is, as I said before, a welcome opportunity for church and state to cooperate, and other people think that it's a slippery slope into something that we shouldn't be doing. And I'll ask you all to comment on that, but we're going to have two more phone calls. I want to ask our listeners in the western part of Montana to call us. We haven't had any calls at all from western Montana. 1-800-441-2941. We have two calls lined up here from Billings, and we will get to those in a row. Go ahead, Billings.
Okay, I guess I'm Billings, number one.
Yeah.
A brief example, if you like, where this thing goes astray, where the lack of separation goes astray, would be my talking to an aged teacher of Indian schools back in the 1940s and thereabouts, so like we're talking 50 years ago. She, a woman, found that she was assigned to put on the Christmas pageant at an Indian school on an Indian reservation, and she put on a fairly secular pageant, songs and so forth, but it was around opening of gifts rather than anything else. Now, she was told later, when they fired her, that you had to do Mary, Joseph, and the Christ Child, and yet the Indians were cringing at that because they were pagan and wished to be and did not want to be forced into it. And the state of Montana was operating the schools on Indian reservations. The school board was entirely white, Protestant, Christian. No Indians allowed, no Catholics allowed, no what have you. So this is just this is real life. This is 50-60 miles from here. It affected the lives of hundreds of people and was terrible. And this poor old woman still says, I don't understand why they fired me for doing that, but they did.
How did it affect their lives adversely?
Well, the children had a religious belief already, and they were forced to.
But this one
like
little
Mary
exposure,
like
this.
Joseph, and to have a baby as a Christ Child, and they didn't believe in Joseph, Mary, the Christ Child, and found it repugnant.
But this one little exposure to that was a complete that completely devastated them. Come well, on, let's be.
It's not one little exposure. It's taking.
Well, you know, if you were engaged,
it's disrespectful
to
is what
play
it is.
The Virgin Mary, you might find it very
well,
offensive.
Well, and that's part of the history I was talking about. The history of how Indians were treated in this country is despicable. They were torn from their religion. They were torn from their homes precisely because we wanted to save their souls. And it's one of the worst pieces of American history. And to say that you can ignore history and that there's nothing going on now that would make us think that if we go the way of saying, oh, it's okay, it's only once or we're a majority and it's okay that we tell these minorities that they have to listen to us saying that our religion is right and your religion is wrong. The Ten Commandments is a perfect example of that. The very first commandment, of course, is thou shalt have no other God before me. Now imagine if you're going into a courthouse and the thing you see hanging over the judge's head says to you, who's not a believer in a monotheistic God, that this judge is, and you are not part of his in crowd, do you really think you're going to feel like you're going to get impartial justice before the law? These things are very problematic.
I think the more you know about another person's, everything about the other person, the more tolerant you're going to be of what they believe and what they feel. I think to shut yourself off.
How understanding was the state of Montana of the native religion of the Indian people? Are you saying that even though they had an official policy of converting these folks, that they respected their native religion?
No, they did not. And you know, they forced, as Indians would tell you, they forced them to throw their medicine bags in the creek or in the Bighorn River or whatever, and down. You know, down around the bend, there was a missionary fishing them out to sell them as they also violated bodies. You know, the Indians were perhaps buried in a tree limb or what tree trunk as they did in their custom, and the whites would, doctor and harden, decapitated one and sold his head to a museum. So mutilation of bodies was fine if they were Indian bodies.
Now, any right-minded person, and I think I'm one of those, would find that abhorrent. I mean,
well, they didn't then.
Well, I would now. And
a friend of mine today, who's Indian, said grandpa was buried on the rims, and by golly, they got him. They dug him up.
And how are we to count on the fact, Al, that you'll be the one the who's going to know what's right and right thinking in religion, and so you can make the good choice for all of us?
I don't know that I'm right thinking in religion. I mean,
you just said you were right-thinking person.
I am a right-thinking person, but
how do you know that?
I know I am by what I see and judge myself by others around me. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know I'm a very right-thinking person compared to many.
We have another caller from Billings. That was caller from Billings number one. Here's number two. Good evening.
Good evening. I want to assure you that your previous caller and I had nothing in common, but I wanted to point out that until Nixon signed the Indian Freedom of Religion Act, Indians were not legally allowed to practice their spirituality. And in fact, even today, most of the prisons won't allow the Indian inmates to have sweat lodges or sings
or
to practice
peyote.
Their spirituality.
Or peyote.
No, I'm not talking about peyote. That's American Indian Church. I'm talking about the spirituality.
Now, Senator Bishop, do you think that peyote was a corruption of religion?
No, I don't think it at all. The Indians used the peyote long before we were ever here.
Okay. All right.
But I think in prison, I mean, the other prisoners don't have access
to all talking about the use of peyote. I'm talking about spirituality, allowing them to have their sweats and allowing them to have the sings. I'm not talking about peyote at all.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You bet.
We have callers lined up here from Bozeman, Glendive, and Laurel, and we'll get to them, but I want to give our panelists a chance to comment on... I want us to get to, if we can, because our time is slipping away. We're over halfway through this program now. No one has commented on the experience that Governor Bush had in Texas and that he has proposed for the nation now to bring religious organizations into partnership with the government in providing social services. And I would like Senator Bishop and Kyle and Scott all to comment on this. And I also would like to hear from some listeners on this, since this is something that the president-elect has announced, that he is establishing an office of faith-based action in the White House based on his Texas experience. Senator Bishop?
Well, yeah, I don't think President-elect Bush has a unique idea. This has been kicked around for as long as I've been in politics. When I campaigned in 1986, that was part of one of the big things, was to try to get... It used to be that the community and the churches took care of the welfare of the people in need, and there's nothing wrong with trying to get back to that. The thing is, though, I don't think the, as I say, it's not a unique idea at all. I'm just not sure that the churches have the wherewithal anymore without some help from government in doing it. And I don't believe government should get involved in conjunction with churches in doing that. I think it should be an either-or situation. The government helps those folks, and to what extent the government doesn't, then the churches can pick up the slack then, but not as a part of any kind of a unified program, no.
Okay, Kyle?
Well, I think it's clearly unconstitutional. But beyond that, it's also bad social policy. It's what I was saying earlier about it's like those who failed to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. It's like we've forgotten the entire Victorian era when that was, in fact, the idea. I mean, people should go read some Dickens novels and see how truly horrible social services were when they were run by just the church. In fact, you know, the progressive movement in large part was based on government being the appropriate power to reach out and help the poor. And as our barely elected president-elect said, you know, leave no one behind. And I don't know how he can tie the two together. It's just a very bad idea. And I think also it doesn't stand a chance to... pass muster.
You don't think it depends on how it's implemented, that it'll just be unconstitutional on its face?
Yes, I think most likely.
All right. Scott?
And probably even more likely in a state scenario, given our state constitution and our explicit prohibition of the commingling of religious activities and government finance program.
We have a caller on the line from Glendive. Go ahead.
Well, I think
let me just finish up and say that
the problem with what this movement of charitable choice, and it takes on different faces depending who's sponsoring what bill. But the problem is that it just begs for the entanglement of government and religion. How can you be certain that the money that is being doled out to a specific mission is being used to provide the services that it's been allocated for, and that's going to be free from proselytizing with it? We get complaints periodically from Christian-based service agencies here, from the people that are going through them, saying, I don't want to have to accept Jesus to accept food. And the fact of the matter is, these are private agencies, and we say, well, we don't have anything to do with that. There's no government forcing you. You don't have to be there if you don't choose.
And the opposite of is, how do you keep government from interfering in religion? If government is giving money to religion, they're entitled to tell religion how to spend it. And that's precisely the other half of the wall of separation of church and state, is to keep government out of religion. And it's a very bad idea.
I agree with Kyle and Scott both on that point, that you can't have a mingling of funds at all. It's either what the government doesn't provide directly to the welfare recipient, it isn't funneled through any church or any religious organization. In no way, shape, or form would that stand muster. I know enough to know better than that. But maybe if we can somehow get the churches and the community back into this thing, maybe it'll take a little bit of the load off government and back where it used to be traditionally. That's communities and the social service, or the churches and that, for the most part, took care of those things back then, and we've shoved everything now off onto government. And that's, maybe it's a more stable, I'll have to agree, the churches and the community probably don't furnish a stable source of funding for those folks, so it maybe allows the idea, I don't know. We'll just have to see what comes up with, but I know there won't be any, I'm sure he doesn't intend to have any mingling of funds or any funneling of funds, government funds, through any religious organization. I can't believe that he would even propose something like that.
Scott, we have four callers lined up. Quick.
Well, let's go to the callers, and
okay.
I'll try to...
And I said Glendive. We will get to Glendive, but Bozeman is first. I'm trying to take them in order here. Bozeman, go ahead.
Hello. This is a really hot issue, and I can see. And I had a question about some speculation on what will happen once this plan is implemented by George Bush. And also... I'm hearing that he had this implemented in Texas, and I'm wondering why that wasn't challenged in the court. Because I'm personally offended by the whole idea, and you know, I agree with Kyle that it historically it's not going to work, and presently it's just not going to work. And my last comment is that as a taxpayer, I feel really good about paying taxes, basically only because you know part of my tax money is used to help others, and so I personally like the fact that government has that role. Thanks.
Okay, and does anyone here know about any challenge to the Texas practice or what the Texas practice was? Okay.
No, I'm okay. Not aware of
no.
what
right.
the practice was.
We have a caller on the line from Glendive.
Yes, I have a friend who works in Central Montana in a state agency, and in such a position that he at times encounters individuals that come to him for help, to the agency for help. And numerous times these individuals report that they first went to the doorstep of the minister of various churches in town for help, and that that minister, rather than offer them help, directed that individual to go to the state. I think that there's plenty of work and help that the churches can do on their own. And I think the lady that you have on this panel is hitting the nail on the head repeatedly. It's essential that we keep church and state separate. She's mentioned a few things in history which demonstrate the horrors that have occurred through human history when you get them mixed up. And many more examples could be added. She's asked repeatedly for folks to study history or to read Dickens. Those things would illuminate the topic greatly. One historian reported that more people were murdered in the Inquisition, which was all about supposedly saving souls, than Hitler killed in the death camps. And that, again, is only one example that can be given in addition to the few that are among the many that could be cited. I think that our founding fathers and mothers, surely there were mothers there too, who separated church and state were brilliant. And that is perhaps the most brilliant thing they did. And if not the most, certainly one of the most brilliant things they did. More suffering has been caused throughout human history by the commingling of those two than anything else I can think of.
Is it possibly, as an old student of politics and religion, is it possibly because of the great importance of politics and religion in the lives of people, that they feel so strongly about these things? I mean, people have just really powerful convictions about their beliefs about God and about morality, and also their beliefs about politics, whether they're to the left or the right. They hang on to those things with great fervor. Is that a reason for the government to just sort of stand back and watch rather than get involved?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking everybody. Go ahead.
I think that is part of the problem, but I think one of the main things that causes that to be a problem is that so many people who receive religious instruction receive poor quality religious instruction. They have religious beliefs that are not very deeply understood or well-founded, and then they hold on to them, like you say, tenaciously. Mm-hmm. One of the things that came to mind during the discussion was that, and the Native American element of the discussion is so apropos. Just as an aside, in the Blackfeet Nation, I heard one of the Blackfeet elders speak, and he talked about how the religious people who went in there supposedly to save their souls ripped those little children from the bosoms of their parents and took them off to a mission called Holy Family. I mean, that's an aside, but it tells a lot. And to continue on with the Native American thought that I had was that Chief Seattle, in his famous speech, after giving great thought to all that he had seen of the invaders and all of the things that had been said, in that great speech of his, said, "One thing that I do know that many of the white people don't seem to realize yet is that their God and our God is the same." And I think that when we come to have a deeper understanding of religion across the globe, we will realize that the Muslim God, the Buddhist God, the Christian God, and all of the gods, that it's the same God. But that doesn't solve the problem, because the atheist still must be respected. And so you still have, you know, a duty to establish a government that is respectful of them.
Okay, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Great comments, thank you.
Yes, we're going to move on to a caller from Laurel. Good evening.
Good evening.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much for having this kind of program. The separation of state and church is something everybody needs to at least study. I recently moved to Montana from Texas, and I worked with the ACLU on a volunteer basis for 2 or 3 years in Texas, and we ran into a severe problem with Governor Bush's program in the Texas Department of Corrections, which was that Bible study groups, faith-based organizations, would promote Bible study groups in the prisons and invite the prisoners to come along to study the Bible. And after a period of study, if they were not Christian, they were invited to become Christian, and they would receive recommendations for parole. And at the ACLU in Texas there, we got several letters from inmates, some of them were Hindus. We had a Muslim, humanists, and some atheists who saw the unfairness of this. They either faced the prospect of going into a Bible study group and pretending to study the Bible and pretending to convert so that they would get a recommend for early release, or they faced serving out the rest of their time. And I do not believe that there was funding from the government for these faith-based groups, but they were allowed to come in, and the argument that the TDC gave us was that we don't have funding to provide an alternative secular counseling system or rehabilitation program for these prisoners. These prisoners have the choice of going through the religious program or none at all. And the difficulty is, with Governor Bush's program, if these religious programs come in and the budgeting is sent elsewhere from the state, then the religious counseling is going to be considered by the various prisons as the counseling system with no alternative. And so you see the difficulty with these prisoners who may be atheists. They're going to have to serve their entire term. The Christian gets out in halftime because he goes to the Bible study group and gets his recommendation.
Did you see any instances in which that actually happened?
Yes, that was happening in Texas. And what my job was to contact the TDC, the Board of Pardons and Paroles, and send them copies of these letters showing that these people were not getting an equal chance at recommendation for parole on the basis of religious preference, which was, of course, we consider to be a violation of the separation of state and church, and certainly is unfair. That did happen, I would say, in Texas. We had about 200 copies on that, 200 cases over a period of 2 or 3 years where prisoners had confronted that, and they were so bothered that they wrote us about it.
Okay.
Now, I don't know what the solution to that would be. I do think it's an argument against allowing faith-based groups to bring their programs in to a state system. And of course, I know you were just discussing the problem of intermingling of governmental funds and church funds, and I see a whole Pandora's box there that could be opened if that funding was commingled.
Well, certainly any prisoner and any prison who wants to have access to a Christian counselor or something like that certainly should have access. You would agree to that.
No, I'm not trying to say he should have counseling. I'm saying there should be equal opportunity for every prisoner.
Okay. All right.
Well, and it's interesting you'd say that. We had a board member who started a Buddhist meditation group at Montana State Prison, and they had a heck of a time coming to grips with certifying her to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of people that came and just said, you know, I'm here not so much because I'm a Buddhist. At least some people, I was told, said this to her. But just to get a place where it's quiet for an hour, it's impossible in this place otherwise. So I think you know, religion offers a refuge for people in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And I can certainly understand...
If you're lacking religion.
Right. Well, I can certainly understand on Governor Bush's standpoint why they couldn't fund it. Their prison system is the biggest in all 50 states.
Right.
We have two callers from Missoula waiting online, but I did want to give the Senator and Kyle both a chance to respond to what's been said here, if you want to.
Well, you know. I think the last caller gave a perfect example of why this idea of Governor Bush's is so bad. This is precisely what we run into all the time in the ACLU. Is, for example, we had a situation here in Montana where a member of the Wiccan religion was denied the right to get books on Wiccan spirituality, and we had to, of course, write the letter and say, you know, you can't discriminate and let Christian literature in and not literature from other religions, and we work that one out. We work these out all the time. Mostly we don't have to file lawsuits, but it sounds like Texas is certainly ripe for a whole slew of lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bishop?
I guess my view would be I'd like to think that the churches are doing everything they can right now. I mean, that they don't have to be encouraged to do more, that they're doing the utmost they can. So I don't see that the program, that such a program would have a lot of merit, frankly. We have a welfare system for state and federal, and that in Montana, that's working well. We've cut down the welfare rolls a lot. Governor Roscoe's welfare plan did that. But as I say, I'd like to think churches are doing everything they can right now, and I don't know that you can push any more onto them, and you surely can't have the government involved in running anything to do with the churches running their organizations or funneling money through them.
We have a caller on the line from Missoula. Good evening.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with the arguments that I've heard so far in opposition to Bush's plan to fund faith-based organizations in order to administer certain social services.
We need to have you speak up for us.
I guess the constitutional argument should be enough in and of itself, but since it's not, I've also heard historical arguments and ideological arguments. But there's also a practical argument, and the gentleman that just spoke a minute ago touched on that when he said that he hoped that faith-based organizations are already doing things for the community in that regard. And that's exactly what I wanted to call for. I attended a hunger and homelessness conference in Helena 2 years ago, and they have this conference every year. And a presentation was given by Professor Paul Miller of Missoula from the University of Montana. And he had surveyed many faith-based organizations throughout the state. And the results were that the faith-based organizations were already overwhelmed by people coming and asking for assistance, for food or shelter or other kinds of assistance. And that they were already overwhelmed at that point. And there was already a clause in the 1996 welfare reform law that faith-based organizations could petition the state or the federal government for money in order to help administer these programs, and they would receive it. That's already in the law. A lot of churches did not do that because it would mean creating their own bureaucracy in order to administer these programs. And so what I wanted to point out is that these faith-based organizations are already overwhelmed. They don't want any more responsibility in that regard. They're already doing all they can do, and they're overwhelmed because of welfare reform legislation in 1996.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And if I can add to what you're saying, caller, you know, I remind people that our state constitution, as late as 1989, protected the needy in our society through a social contract that said that we will look after those citizens who, for reasons of age, infirmity, or misfortune, are in need of assistance from society. That was our state contract in our original Constitution and in our 1972 Constitution. The legislature passed a referendum that they took to the people, which then, it was CI 18, and a small majority of people decided to make null and void that social contract.
Right.
Now, when I was talking to churches about that 12 years ago, some of them were moved by the gospel to take on administering to the poor, but most of them opposed the constitutional change for the very reason that you're saying, that they already could not help with utility bills and food and shelter and emergency needs for those who were without in our society. Now, what complicates this even more is that if the tax cuts that are being proposed by Governor Bush for the wealthiest people in this country pass, the incentive for tax-deductible contributions to churches and charities is going to evaporate.
Right.
So a good portion of the private funding that's already there is going to dry up. So I think that you start chasing your own tail in this argument, and I think it could be very self-defeating for the social welfare, which I think is what we should be concerned about when we're talking about government.
Precisely. And I wanted to point out, too, that Bush, as a Republican, promotes less government in people's lives. And inherently, letting faith-based organizations provide social services is in some way letting those organizations make determinations about people's lives that poor people, you know, by virtue of not having the resources, can't make for themselves. Whereas if they had the resources, they'd be able to make decisions for themselves and are perfectly capable of doing it. I'm one, I can say that.
And thank you.
So it's I think it's a good idea and a Republican idea to reduce, even eliminate, the welfare bureaucracy, which is extremely bloated,
mm-hmm.
and to spend that money directly, more directly, by tax credits to working poor families and reforming the tax code in some way so that those families who don't earn enough income to even, file a tax form would still be eligible for some credit. You know, if we had that little bit of extra money every month or, you know, in a big lump sum in a year, we could get by without having to knock on the church's doors or to go down to the welfare office and apply for food stamps, or go to the human resources office and apply for energy assistance. That, you know, that we really need the cash, and we are best equipped to figure out how to spend that.
Thank you much.
Uh-huh.
All right, that caller from Missoula, and we have a caller on the line from just outside Great Falls. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening.
Go ahead.
It's a good show that you've got tonight.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment on one thing in particular on the faith-based groups that in Texas, I've read a little bit about it and saw some things on some documentaries, and I think most of those, not all of them, were volunteer groups. And I think that this idea that we're going to discourage these volunteer groups from providing this service because one segment is that they're not going to cater to one minority segment, I think is not a very good situation to get into. I think it was you that brought up the individual that was performing, you know, some service in Deer Lodge, whether it's meditation or whatever. I think all those things that we can get that in there to help those individuals is a great thing, and to discourage it, I think, you know, the ACLU to go in and fight something like that, because those volunteers are not providing a service to another religion, I think, is kind of short-sighted. Don't you agree?
Well, is there opposition on the part of the ACLU to people counseling from various religions, counseling people independently? I mean, it's
absolutely not.
It's when it becomes a government program that you have a problem.
That's correct.
Or when it becomes exclusive and people that want it from a non-majoritarian viewpoint are denied it.
Yeah, okay. All right. Now, I want to clarify that because I wasn't hearing any opposition from the ACLU
That isn't the way it came across just a little while ago when we're talking about President-elect Bush and his what happened in Texas. That consensus, the way it sounded to me, was that if he promotes anything like this on the national level that was happening on the state level, that it's going to be, that it'd be crazy for him to even consider it.
I think what the caller before was saying that we were commenting on was what he said happened on the state level was that one religion, Christianity, was preferred over another, and that you could get
a parole only if
you accepted Christ as your personal Savior, and that certainly we would challenge.
There should be no connection, I would think, by the state between your conversion to religion and the shortening of your sentence.
Yeah, the only thing is, the only reason that the state would get involved is that they would see a change in the individual's behavior. And of course, that's what we're looking at is behavioral modification when we incarcerate these.
But that didn't happen with Carla, remember?
Carla Tucker.
She was a born-again Christian of several years who was executed in Texas. So it didn't help her any, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's going to be all kinds of specifics. And I'd like to also just mention that I'm involved somewhat in a religious group that caters somewhat to people's welfare and such, and we seem to be doing all right with our funds and resources, and I just hate to think that the people get the idea that the only governance organization, and I'll put those words that way, that are providing social services is going to end up being the government. There's other things out there that are working fine, and I hope they continue to work.
How would you feel as somebody who administers or participates in that if you were given federal money?
We wouldn't take it. No, it wouldn't,
why not?
It wouldn't be an option.
Why not?
I would speak to it, and these thoughts came to mind as I was listening to some things, is that there may be programs that the government would have that would want us to administer them, but the amount of paperwork and the things that we'd have to do to work with that money would be unbearable and something that we
That is something if the government has a distinctive quality of adding paperwork to these things, other strings.
Yeah. You know, and I appreciate what was brought up on Jefferson's comment that it's a two-way wall. I don't quite subscribe to the strict interpretation that some are putting on that, but, it is a two-way thing. It is two-way, and we should maintain that.
Okay, and
yeah,
if anybody else out there who is involved, either from a religious organization or any non-governmental organization, in providing social services to people who would like to call and comment on what they do and what they think about the Faith-Based Action Office, by all means do so. We are down to our last 11-12 minutes here before we end this program. It has gone very rapidly. I am going to give Senator Bishop and Kyle a chance to sort of catch up with some of the things that these callers have said. Senator, do you have any reaction to any of the comments that have been made here?
Oh, not really. I've answered most that I want to, but Marvin, I would like to ask you, do we know the specifics? Do you know the specifics of Bush's plan? I mean, what is he proposing, I mean, specifically?
All he has done is to announce the establishment in the White House of an Office of Faith-Based Action. And during the campaign, he said that he intended to do this based on his experience as governor of Texas. So that's why I was asking people if they knew specifically what had gone on in Texas and how churches and government work together in this way. This is something that, and one man did call and say he had some direct experience with that. That is something that I raised the question here because it relates to the Constitution.
And they were volunteers, I think the fellow in Texas said it. Am I wrong or not? Did he say that the people who were involved in that program in Texas were volunteers?
I think that's what he said,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I would find no problem with that.
Well, it's not the volunteer aspect of what the folks were doing. What the problem, from what the gentleman was explaining, was that there was only one choice. You could get parole by becoming a Christian and probably a certain variety of Christian, and you weren't given the opportunity to get parole, for example, if you became a devout Hindu or a devout Muslim.
Yeah.
And that is problematic.
Yeah, well, that's that's not good, Kyle.
I would agree with you. It's not good, and it sounds like that's what was going on.
We had a lot of changes. When I was a child in southern Michigan in a rural county, there were 8 Baptist churches in the small city that they used to say we had more Baptist churches than bars in our county, and I'm sure that wasn't true. And they all were different Baptist churches of different faiths. But a conservative Baptist clergyman came to my elementary school with his felt board and his little characters and taught us Christianity every few weeks. And time was made available to him to do this, sort of like he was providing a public service. And my mother wasn't enthusiastic about it, but she also was not one to make a lot of difficulty for people, so she sort of accepted it. I was, you know, a kid, and I shudder to think that if we lived in a society where my kids could be exposed to that sort of thing now, because I thought, you know, what if the other kids in this classroom who might be Jewish, who might be Native American, who might be of a family that didn't believe in religion at all, he was there to teach everybody, and everybody had to listen. And we've had a lot of changes since then, and maybe some teachers go overboard in being afraid that the court might not approve what they do, so they don't, you know, they don't allow things that really could go on.
Well, but, you know, that's a good point. They actually, not understanding what the Supreme Court has said, they do go overboard. The Supreme Court has never said you can't teach about religion.
Sure.
It's what you can't do is impose religion or teach religion as truth. And, in fact, I think from some of the discussion we've had tonight, it's a good thing to teach about religion and history. It's a good thing to teach comparative religion because it makes people more understanding and gives a background to understanding why the separation of church and state has been such an important part of the success of this country.
We have a caller on the line from Billings.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Yes, I just would like to respond to what you were just talking about his specifically the office. This office will cost money unless it's volunteered, and the time he spends on it costs us money, and that's a matter of fact. And so I think right there it's unconstitutional. The other thing is, whenever you funnel money into an organization like a church, you provide the opportunity for them to free up funds to spend on their missionary work or whatever. So, in fact, you're supporting their missionary work. The other thing is, the thing that I object to the most about the concept is anything in a public context where a specific religion is sanctioned or used in that context is disrespectful to each and every other believing person or unbelieving person. That's my basic objection to it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yep.
And we have another call from Billings. You're on the air. Go ahead, sir. Or ma'am.
Yes, I am definitely opposed to a faith-based office in the White House. I feel that is definitely a commingling of church and state, and we shouldn't do that. I also am opposed to school vouchers. If I pay my taxes to the school system, I expect my money to go to make better public schools. And if it is your choice to go to a faith-based school or a private school, then you use your private money to do that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our phone number is 1-800-441-2941. We do have a few more minutes here for calls. And, Scott, you had your hand raised.
Thank you, Marvin, for recognizing me. They've got me in the corner here, folks, literally. But my point to support what the last caller just said about about vouchers, it is another angle on charitable choice. The choice of language for bills is so critical. When it's discussed on a federal level, they talk about opportunity scholarships. Well, how could you be opposed to an opportunity scholarship? But what happens is that money, you know, if you're supporting private schools, 85% of the private schools in this country are related to churches. So it's you know, no matter how you want to dress it up or how you want to camouflage it with language, It is exactly as this woman is saying, is that we are subsidizing with tax dollars. And the good news in Montana is that even the Roscoe administration came to the conclusion with an independent study during the first term of Governor Roscoe's service that a voucher scheme in Montana could not fly because it would run contrary to our state prohibitions against commingling church and state.
One thing that bothers me about this, Scott, is that many black leaders of inner-city neighborhoods support some kind of voucher program, and it's usually white liberals telling them they can't do it.
I think if you could sit down with them and talk about adequately funding public education, they might have a different attitude about it. But when you're...
They've heard that for so long.
Well, but I do think that that's a key element in the discussion. If what you're getting is crumbs from the table, you might very much want to look at eating at a different table.
But the poor always get crumbs from the table, whether it's toxic waste cleanup or whatever. I mean, they just do. That's part of nature. I mean, it's part of our society. So, I mean, why? What's wrong with folks in these neighborhoods that have traditionally very poor schools seeking some kind of totally different way of providing their kids a decent education?
I mean, if vouchers would in fact allow a poor person to send their child to a private school, and let's say it's not a church-based school, you could talk about that. But nobody could pay the tuition with tax vouchers.
Why not a Catholic school if it's their money that's given to them as a citizen?
Reason that you're saying that it's not a good idea to commingle on other fronts. Who's going to decide when the Catholics are preaching Catholicism?
Okay.
And who's going to decide when they're teaching history?
Okay. Want your answer to that.
I agree with Scott on that. I think it's a dilution of our resources to even think about that. I'm a strong believer in the public school concept, and I think we ought to spend our energies and our monies on, quote, fixing, unquote, our schools if they're broke. I don't know that money is a complete answer, Scott, to that. I think there's a lot of things there that need looking into: accountability, tenure, things like that that are critical to fixing the school systems. It isn't necessarily money. Utah, for instance, spends the least of any of the 50 states per student, the very least per student, and yet their students are always among the top five. Now, why do you suppose, what's the answer to that? Does anybody care to venture?
Oh, it's the homogeneity of the society, very tight, responsible family structure due to their majority religion. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are contributing to that.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that's something that we can't do. We can't build stable family backgrounds, families. We can't create stable families. We've got to educate the people. We can't put them in place. We've got to get the education system broad enough to include those people so that they'll know how to. Some of those people don't know how to build a stable family. They don't know how to conduct and what kind of a relationship they're supposed to have in a family.
We have very little time left, and it's bothering me that Senator Bishop and Kyle and Scott are getting to agree too much here. So I'm glad we're at the end of it. We have one more caller. You have 1 minute. This is a cell phone from Bozeman. Can you get it in 1 minute?
Are you there, sir?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'll certainly try to.
Okay.
And I'm perhaps from a little bit different perspective from the faith-based organization, and I guess I have been also in the prison system for certain instances as well, and seen a little bit what happens and the success of a lot of these, where I guess my main question is, why are you so scared of systems that work? And also, where in the Constitution is it written a specific for the separation of church and state? It is perhaps clear to me that there is none such, and also that it is more of a, an insinuation rather than an actual written in the Constitution itself.
Our time is up, I'm afraid.
Okay, I thank you very much.
I wish you'd called earlier.
Yes.
All right, we've been talking about church-state relations, sectarian civics, in a series called A Living Bill of Rights. State Senator Al Bishop of Billings has been in the studio with us tonight, along with Kyle Gray and Scott Crichton. Kyle is a private practicing attorney here in Billings, and Scott Crichton is the executive director of the American Civil Liberty Union of Montana. In January, on the 25th, another Thursday night, we have another non-controversial subject, and that is homosexuality, equal rights, or special rights. And we hope you'll join us then. This has been a cooperative venture of Yellowstone Public Radio and Montana Public Radio.